I felt strong arms reach round my shoulders, pulling me. Simon's face became abruptly visible.
Joe! God! Oh, my God! Fucking hell, fuck, look at you. Shit, Richard, hold him. Lift him. Lift him, you stupid bastard. God, Joe, how? How?
Too shocked to realize what he was saying, his words tumbled out in an obscene litany, expletives said for no reason, a meaningless stream of obscenities, with Richard hovering, nervous, scared of the pain.
Dying. Couldn't take any more. Too much for me. Too much. Thought it was over. Please help, for God's sake, help me.
You'll be okay, I've got you. I have you, you're safe. Then Simon was hauling me up with his arms round my chest, dragging me, heels bumping over the rocks. Dropped heavily by the doorway of the tent in a soft glow of candlelight from within, I looked up to see Richard staring down at me, wide-eyed with apprehension. I wanted to giggle at the fuss, but tears kept crawling from my eyes, and I could speak no words. Then Simon dragged me into the tent and laid me gently back against a mass of warm down sleeping bags. He knelt by my side staring at me, and I could see a confusion of pity and horror and alarm fighting in his eyes. I smiled at him, and he grinned back, shaking his head slowly from side to side.
"Thanks, Simon," I said. "You did right."
I saw him turn quickly away, averting his eyes.
"Anyway, thanks."
He nodded silently. The tent was full of warm light from the candle. People seemed to hover over me. Shadows played on the tent walls. An immense tiredness seemed suddenly to drain my strength. I lay still, feeling my back pressing through the soft down. Faces peered over me, two faces, constantly appearing in brief visions, confusing me. Then Richard was pressing a plastic mug into my hand. Tea. Hot tea. But I couldn't hold it. Simon took it from me, helped me sit up, and then fed me the tea. I saw Richard busy over the gas stove, stirring thick, milky porridge, spooning sugar in as he stirred. More tea followed, and the porridge, which I couldn't eat. I stared across at Simon, seeing the haggard tension in his face and the shock in his eyes. For a moment nothing was said. With a start, I recognized the last time I had seen Simon look at me in this way. He had stood at the top of the ice cliff and stared at me for that moment too long. That instant moment when I knew he had accepted I would die. Then the spell was broken, and we burst into a torrent of questions, all blurted out at the same time, yet mostly unanswered. In that long, silent meeting of eyes, every question had become futile, every answer superfluous. I told him of the crevasse and the crawling. He told of his nightmare descent after the cutting and how he knew I was dead. He looked at me then as if he couldn't quite grasp that I had come back. I smiled and touched his hand.
"Thank you," I said again,
knowing it could never tell him what I felt. He seemed embarrassed and quickly changed the subject.
"I burnt all your clothes."
"What?"
"Well, I thought you weren't..."
He burst out laughing at the expression on my face, and I laughed with him. We kept at it for too long, and the sounds were harsh, almost manic. Hours went by without us noticing, and the tent filled with a babble of voices blurting out our stories, laughing at the money search and all my underwear now burnt outside the tent, endless cups of tea given with concern, and now a deep, abiding friendship. And at every gesture, a touch on the arm, a look, an intimacy we would never have dared show before and never would again. It reminded me of those storm-swept hours on the face, when for a short time we had played parts in our very own clichéd third-rate war film. Simon forced me to finish the porridge as Richard prepared fried egg sandwiches. It seemed I swallowed a different drug with every sip of tea, painkillers and Ronacol and antibiotics. I balked at the sandwiches, unable to swallow the dry bread. "Eat it," Simon said sternly. I coughed at the dry bread catching in my throat and mouthed it helplessly. I could get no saliva into my mouth, so, despite his order, I spat it out. "Right, let's take a look at your leg." He had suddenly become stern and efficient. I started to protest, but he had already begun to cut my tattered over-trousers with a penknife. I saw the blade slicing effortlessly through the thin nylon material. It was red-handled. My knife. The last time it had been used on me was 3.5 days ago. A spasm of fear ran through me. I didn't want any more pain, not today at least. Sleep was what I craved. Warm, downy sleep. I flinched when he raised my leg to pull the trousers away. It's okay. I'll be as careful as possible. I glanced from him to Richard, who looked as if he was going to be sick. I grinned at him, but he turned away and busied himself with the stove. I was both excited and apprehensive to see what my leg looked like. I wanted to know what had been causing me so much agony, but I was scared of seeing it rotten and infected. Simon unzipped my gaiters and gently released the laces and Velcro catches. "Richard, you're going to have to hold his leg down. I can't pull the boot off unless you keep it firm." Richard hesitated by the stove. "Can't you cut the boot off?" "Yes, but it's unnecessary. Come on. It'll only be for a second." He moved to my side and held my leg gingerly below the knee. Simon began pulling at the boot, and I screamed, "Grip it tight, for Christ's sake!" He pulled again, and the pain seemed to balloon up from my knee. I squeezed my eyes shut and whimpered at the gathering flood of fire in my knee, praying for it to stop. "Right, got it." The pain ebbed quickly away. Simon threw the boot out of the tent, and Richard hurriedly let go of my leg. I think he'd had his eyes closed as well. My polo trousers followed, sliding gently from my legs. Richard moved to the back of the tent, and I sat up expectantly. When Simon pulled my thermal long johns off, we both gawped at my leg in astonishment. "Bloody hell. Fuck me, it's enormous." The leg was a bloated stump, stained yellow and brown, with livid purple streaks running down from the knee. There was no discernible difference between my thigh and my ankle. Only the hugely distended lump, which twisted grotesquely to the right halfway down, showed where the knee had been. "God, it's worse than I thought." I felt weak at the sight of it, and reached forward tentatively to stroke the skin around my knee. At least there was no angry inflammation, no obvious signs of infection. "It's bad," Simon muttered. He was examining the underside of my foot. "You've broken your heel as well."
"Have I? Oh, well."
It didn't seem very important to me. Foot, knee, the whole caboodle, what did it matter? I was down. I could rest and eat and sleep. It would mend.
"Yes, see those purple streaks? They're signs of hemorrhaging. You have them all around your heel and the ankle as well."
"Here you go, Richard," I said. "Take a look at this." He peered over my shoulder and then pulled away hurriedly. "Oh, I wish I hadn't." I laughed happily, noticing how quickly I had changed. The manic hysterical laughter had become a thing of the past. Simon pulled my long johns back over my legs with a worried expression on his face. "We'll have to get you out of here quickly. The donkeys are coming in the morning. One of us can go down and ask Spinoza to bring a mule and his saddle as well."
"I'll go," Richard volunteered. "It's 4:30 now. I'll go after this tea. That way you can use my sleeping bag and Joe can take yours. I'll be back by 6.
"Hang on," I interrupted. "I need rest and food. I can't cope with 2 days on a mule straight away."
"You'll just have to," Simon said sharply. "There's no question about it. It'll be 3 days at least before you get to a hospital. You've got frostbite as well as the leg, and you're exhausted. If you leave it any longer, it'll get infected."
"But forget it. We go in the morning. It will have been broken for over a week by the time we reach Lima. You can't risk it."
I felt too weak to argue and looked imploringly at the two of them, hoping they would change their minds. Simon ignored me and began feeding my legs into his sleeping bag. Richard passed me some tea, smiled reassuringly, and then stepped out into the night.
"Be back soon,"
he shouted from the darkness, but already I was falling asleep. There seemed to be something important still to do before I slept, but I was losing the struggle to keep my eyes open. Then I remembered.
"Simon."
"What?"
"You saved my life, you know. It must have been terrible for you that night. I don't blame you. You had no choice. I understand that, and I understand why you thought I was dead. You did all that you could have done. Thanks for getting me down."
He said nothing, and when I looked across at him lying on his back in Richard's bag, there were tears on his cheeks. I turned away as he spoke. "Honestly, I thought you were dead. I was sure of it. Couldn't see how you would possibly have survived."
"It's okay. I know."
"God, coming down alone. Coming down, I couldn't bear it. I mean, what was I going to say to your parents? What? I'm sorry, Mrs. Simpson, but I had to cut the rope. She'd never understand, never believe me. It's all right. You don't have to now. I wish I'd stayed longer. Just believed you could still be alive. It would have saved you so much. Doesn't matter. We're here now. It's over. Yes. He said it in a choked whisper, and I felt the unstoppable flood of hot tears filling my eyes. How much he had been through, I could only guess at. A second later, I was asleep. I awoke to a hubbub of voices and laughter. Girls' voices chattered excitedly in Spanish close by the tent, and I heard Simon talking to Richard about the donkeys. I opened my eyes slowly to the unfamiliar glow of the tent walls. Sun dappled the red and green fabric, and shadows passed by every few seconds. It seemed as if there was a bazaar in full trade outside the tent. I remembered with a shock the events of a few hours before. I was safe. It was true. I smiled drowsily and moved my arms against the silken, downy sides of the sleeping bag, luxuriating in the feeling of homecoming. It had been so bad, I thought idly in half-sleep, so very bad. An hour later, I started from sleep to a voice calling my name from far away. I felt confused. Who was calling me? Sleep dragged me softly back to the warmth of the bag, but the voice kept calling. Come on, Joe, wake up! I rolled my head to the side and looked blearily at the heads crowded into the doorway. Simon knelt there with a steaming mug of tea in his hand, and behind him the two girls peered curiously over his shoulder. I tried to sit up, but couldn't move. A great weight was pressing down onto my chest, pinning me to the ground. I swung my arm feebly in an effort to haul myself up, but it flopped limp at my side. Arms reached round my shoulders and pulled me into a sitting position. Drink this and try to eat. You need it. I cupped the mug in my gloved hands and crouched over it, feeling the steam wetting my face. Simon moved away, but the girls remained squatting near the door, smiling at me. There was something unreal about them sitting there in the sun, watching me drink tea. Their wide-hipped peasant skirts and flower-strewn hats seemed very strange. What were they doing here? My mind seemed to be running off at tangents from second to second, so that I couldn't fully grasp what was happening. I had got here safely. I understood the tents, and Simon and Richard, but not these weirdly dressed Peruvians. I decided that the best thing to do was ignore them and concentrate on my tea. It scalded my mouth with the first sip. The gloves which protected my frozen fingers and the lack of sensation in my hands made me forget how hot it would be. I gasped and blew quickly, trying to cool the tip of my tongue. The girls giggled. An endless stream of food and drink followed during the next half hour, along with quick snippets of encouragement and information about what was happening. There was some delay because Spinoza was being bloody-minded about payment for the mules. I could hear Simon's voice getting louder and more infuriated with every passing minute. I heard Richard translating calmly to Spinoza. The girls occasionally looked over at Simon and frowned. Then suddenly they were gone, and there was no more need to stay awake. I slumped forward and drifted into sleep, letting the chaotic Spanish-English row fade into the background. A hand shook me awake again. It was Simon. You'll have to get out of the tent now. We're packing up. He's finally agreed on a price, and if he changes his mind again, I'm going to rip his bloody head off. I tried to shuffle round to move out of the tent, and I was horrified by how weak I'd become. I fell sideways as my arm buckled beneath me when I was half out of the tent, and I couldn't push myself up again. Simon lifted me gently and dragged me clear of the sun. Simon, I'll never be able to cope with the mule. You don't know how weak I am. It'll be all right. We'll help you. Help me? I can hardly stay awake, let alone sit up. How can you help me ride a mule, for Christ's sake? I need rest. I really do. I need sleep and food. I've only had 3 hours sleep since I got down. You've got no choice. You're going today, and that's that. I tried to protest, but he was having none of it. He walked over to the tent and returned with the first aid box. Richard passed me another mug of tea, while Simon handed me my quota of pills. Then they left me and began dismantling the camp. I lay on my side, watching them until I couldn't fight off the appalling, drowsy weakness any longer. The deterioration scared me deeply, and made me wonder anxiously whether I had burnt myself out completely. It occurred to me that I was nearer to death than when I had been alone. The minute I knew help was at hand, something had collapsed inside me. Whatever had been holding me together had gone. Now I could not think for myself, let alone crawl. There was nothing to fight for, no patterns to follow, no voice, and it frightened me to think that without these, I might run out of life. I tried to stay awake, fighting to shake the sleep away and keep my eyes open, but the sleep won. I dozed fitfully, waking to the babble of different languages and dozing off again to the recurrent thoughts of comas, collapse, and unwaking sleep. It seemed a long time before Simon came to me again. I heard his voice talking to Richard and looked up. He stood by my side, examining me with a worried expression on his face. "Hello. Are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm okay."
I had abandoned any idea of resisting the plan to leave. "You don't look it. We'll be leaving soon. Perhaps it would be better if you sat up and tried to liven yourself up a bit. I'll get you some tea." I laughed at the thought of being livened up, but managed to sit up unaided all the same. Eventually Spinoza led his old mule to me, and Simon helped me to my feet. Leaning heavily on his shoulder, I hopped towards the mule, which waited patiently. It looked a pleasant-natured, calm old animal, which encouraged me. As I was about to be lifted into the saddle, Richard suddenly called out, "Hang on, Simon, we've forgotten his money!" A hobbling search then began, with Richard and Simon supporting me on either side, as I directed them from rock to rock, vainly trying to remember where I had hidden the money belt. Spinoza and the girls looked puzzled. We laughed happily until at last we found the belt and held it up for them to see. They smiled politely but clearly didn't understand what was so important about a tattered piece of tubular climbing tape. The saddle was one of those old-style, high-pommeled Western affairs with huge cups of carved leather for stirrups and ornate silver inlays around the pommel. A carry mat had been bent over the saddle as a cushion and to keep my injured leg swinging out free from the mule's flank. We set off down the riverbed at a steady walk, with Simon and Richard walking on each side of me, keeping a watchful eye on my condition. The next 2 days were a blur of exhaustion and pain. I couldn't squeeze my thighs together to steer the mule, and it seemed to walk into every tree, boulder, and wall that we passed in the 20-hour journey to Cajatambo. Even with Simon spiking it with a sharpened snow stake, it still blundered on, and I screamed and howled impotently until the pain died. Somehow I managed not to fall. The familiar landscape drifted past me blurred by pain and exhaustion. At the end of each day, childish tantrum feelings would rush through me. I no longer had the strength or desperation to cope with this added torment. I wanted it finished, wanted to get home. Simon mothered me down through the bad times, walking back and forth on the trail, goading the donkey driver to increase his pace, exhorting the man pulling my mule to take care, and walking close by my side when sleep and weakness threatened to topple me from the saddle. He took my watch from me, and halted the march every time a new drug had to be administered. Painkillers, Ronicol, antibiotics, and the inevitable tea. Tempers frayed around me as I drifted in and out of sleep, while the mule walked doggedly on through high passes, steep rocky valleys, and lush pampas. But Simon stayed close by my side, encouraging some faint boost of strength whenever I pleaded for a rest. Cajatambo was a mayhem of hassle as Simon battled with the police to hire a pickup truck, and then both he and Richard fought off the hordes of villagers trying to climb into the back for a free lift to Lima. At the last minute, a young man approached the truck. I lay stretched out on a mattress in the open back. He looked sorrowfully at me, seeing the crude splint on my leg. A policeman with a machine pistol slung across his chest stepped forward and stopped Richard trying to remove the last villager from the truck. "Señor, please for you to help this man. His legs are bad. 6 days he waits. You take him to hospital. Yes?" There was a shocked silence as we all turned to examine the old man slumped beside me in the back of the truck. He looked imploringly at me, and then, grimacing with pain, he rolled his hips and flicked aside the crude sacking covering his legs. The crowd was suddenly deathly silent, and I heard the sharp intake of breath from Simon close by me. The man's legs were smashed. I had a brief glimpse of two distorted legs, ripped open, raw wounds, blood stains, and the deep, angry purple colour of infection. A sharp, sweet stench rose from the blanket as he replaced it gingerly over his legs. "My God, I felt sick." "He is bad, yes?" "Bad?" He hasn't a hope.
I'm sorry, my English is not good. It's okay, we'll take him. And this man, I interrupted.
Thank you, senor. You are kind men.
The driver was an alcoholic who supplied us with generous quantities of beer. Beer, cigarettes, and painkillers gave a cloudy film to my memory of those 3 days struggling back to Lima. Late that night we arrived at the hospital. The old man, we were told, could not afford a good hospital like this. We said it was no problem and paid the driver for the hire of the truck, with instructions to take the man to his hospital. As Richard helped me out of the truck, Simon gave the man's son our last remaining supplies of painkillers and antibiotics. The truck pulled away into a muggy, hot Lima night, and from my wheelchair I saw the old man trying feebly to wave his thanks before it turned the corner of the street. The hospital was frighteningly out of date by our standards, but there were clean white sheets, tinned music from the ward speakers, and pretty nurses, none of whom spoke a word of English. They wheeled me briskly down the green and white corridors, with Simon hurrying beside me, unable to relinquish me from his care. The enormity of what we had been through was just beginning to sink in. An hour later, Simon and Richard had been brusquely told to leave. After being x-rayed, my stinking climbing clothes had been taken away to be washed, and I was sat naked on a set of chair scales as a pretty nurse took my pulse, noted my weight, and drew a blood sample from my arm. I turned to see the scales and was horrified. 7¼ stones. 3 stones. God, I'd lost 3 stones. She grinned cheerfully at me before scooping me off the chair and lowering me gently into a deep bath of hot, disinfected water. When she had done with me, I was put to bed and instantly fell asleep. An hour later she was back, this time with a concerned-looking doctor. He explained something frightening and complicated about my blood sample while she punctured a vein in my wrist and set up a glucose drip. I woke in the night from dreadful nightmare memories of the crevasse, soaked in sweat and panicked to screaming point until the nurses came with words of kindness that I couldn't understand. I lay there for 2 indescribable days without food, painkillers or antibiotics until my insurance was confirmed by Telex and they deigned to operate on me. They came for me early in the morning. A pre-med injection in my arm an hour earlier had reduced me to a familiar, enfeebled, barely conscious state. 2 people, masked, wearing green, muttered unintelligibly at me as they wheeled me down seemingly endless tiled corridors. It wasn't until we neared the operating theatre that the fear in my stomach rose up as panic. I mustn't go through with this. Must stop them. Wait until you get home. For the love of God, don't let them do it. I don't want the operation. I said it calmly. I thought that I had said it clearly, but they did not answer. Perhaps the drug has affected my speech. I repeated the sentence. One of them nodded at me, but they didn't stop. Then it hit me. They don't understand English. I tried to sit up, but someone pushed me back onto the pillows. I shouted, panic-stricken, for them to stop. The trolley clattered through the swing doors of the operating theatre. A man spoke to me in Spanish. His voice was melodic. He was trying to calm me, but the sight of him checking a syringe made me struggle to a half-sitting position. Please, I don't... A strong hand pressed me back. Another gripped my arm, and I felt the slight pain of the needle. I tried to lift my head, but somehow it had doubled in weight. Turning to the side, I saw a tray of instruments. Above me, bright lights came on, and the room began to swim before my eyes. I had to say something. Had to stop them. Darkness slipped over the lights, and slowly, all sounds muffled down to silence. Postscript. June 1987. Hunza Valley, Karakoram Himalayas, Pakistan. I watched the 2 small figures gradually dwindle into invisibility on the bleak hillside above me. Andy and John were going for the summit of the unclimbed 20,000-foot Tupidam. I was alone again in the mountains, but I had chosen to be. I turned away and tended the little gas stove heating my 2nd cup of coffee. The movement made my knee ache. I swore irritably and leant forward to massage the pain away. Arthritis. The scars of 6 operations stood out lividly on the distorted joint. At least the wounds in my mind had healed better than these. The doctors had told me I would get arthritis. They had said the whole knee joint would have to be removed within the next 10 years. But then they had said a lot of things, few of which were true. You will never bend the knee again, Mr. Simpson. You'll have a permanent limp.
You'll never climb again.
They were right about the arthritis, though, I thought ruefully, as I turned off the stove and glanced anxiously back to the hillside. The first sharp stab of fear for them tremored through me.
Come back safe.
At least do that, I whispered to the now silent hills. Given fine weather, they should be down in 3 days. I knew it would be a long wait. I felt sad to have dropped out of the summit attempt. The leg had worked so well, but then the pain had started. I knew that to climb here only 10 weeks after the last operation was inviting fresh injury, but I was glad I had tried, and there was always next year. 6 days earlier, we had reached the col beneath the shoulder of our mountain and dug a snow cave. We had sat outside, gazing silently at the Himalayas stretching away from us. The sun had burnt down from an endless blue sky, and the sea of snow summits was etched sharply in the crystal clear air. This was what I had come to see. Pristine, untouchable. Lofting into the sky, perfectly beautiful. The sun glittered diamante reflections off frozen snow crystals. Karen Koh loomed above, only 5 miles distant. I fancied I could see the curve of the earth in the limitless horizon of peaks set before me. I tried to believe I could see Everest, despite knowing it was 1,000 miles from here. The names of the ranges rolled through my mind. The Hindu Kush, the Pamirs, Tibet, and the Karakorams. Everest, goddess mother of the snows. Nanda Devi, K2, Nanga Parbat, Kanchenjunga. So much history in those names. And of all those who had climbed on them. Suddenly they were real to me, as they never would have been had I chosen not to return. Somewhere out in those serried peaks lay the bodies of two of my friends, alone, buried in the snows on different mountains. That was the dark side of this beauty, which for this moment I could close from my mind. I packed my rucksack, shouldered it, and, after one last look towards where they had disappeared, turned away and began the walk back to camp. 10 years on. In his book about another climb in the Andes, Against the Wall, published in 1997, Simon Yates was kind enough to acknowledge that I had told his side of the Sula Grande story faithfully and truly in Touching the Void, and he ruminated on the questions of conscience that might have remained a decade or so after the event. I'm so relieved to hear him say that his conscience is clear, for he did what I would have done in his place, the only sensible course open to him at the end of a heroic attempt to rescue me. He wrote,
"Some would argue that there was no decision to be made, that cutting the rope and the powerful symbol of trust and friendship it represents should never have entered my mind. Others say that it was simply a matter of survival, something I was forced to do. As it happened, for a long time I simply hung on, hoping that Joe would be able to take his weight off the rope and relieve my position. By the time I remembered I had a knife in the top of my rucksack, I was at the end of my tether, unable to hold him for much longer. I knew I had done all that could reasonably be expected of me to save Joe, and now, both our lives were being threatened, I had reached a point where I had to look after myself. Although I knew my action might result in his death, I took the decision intuitively in a split second. It simply felt the right thing to do, like so many critical decisions I had taken during the climb. Without hesitation, I removed the knife from the rucksack and cut the rope. Such moments of intuition always seem to feel the same, impersonal, as if the decision has not come from my own mind. Only with hindsight could I see there had been a build-up to that moment. During the days before, we had made many errors of judgment. We had not eaten or drunk enough, and carried on climbing long after nightfall. By doing so, we had allowed ourselves to become cold, exhausted, and dehydrated. One evening I became so cold waiting outside for Joe to finish digging a snow hole that some of my fingers became frostbitten. In short, we had not looked after ourselves.
I can see now that Simon is right, though I didn't always view it this way, as a matter of neglect. Analyzing after a climb what you did correctly or incorrectly is as important as being fit or talented, so it was natural that for several years I too mulled over what had happened and tried to work out where we had gone wrong and what vital mistakes we had made. At first I was convinced we had done nothing wrong.
I would still have back-climbed the ice cliff in the way I did, although perhaps with a little more care about the quality of the ice. We would still have climbed alpine style, used snow caves instead of tents, and carried the same equipment and food. It was Simon who eventually pointed out to me where we had made our fatal mistake, and it happened before we left base camp. Gas. We hadn't allowed ourselves enough gas to keep us adequately hydrated. One small canister between the two of us per day was simply insufficient. So as to save weight, we had pared everything down to the minimum. It left us no room to manoeuvre when things started to go so drastically wrong. When Simon lowered me to near the Santa Rosa Col, and before we committed ourselves to descending the west face in a gathering storm and imminent darkness, we had considered digging a snow cave and sitting the storm out. If we had done that, we could have made the lowers on a bright and sunny day. We would have seen and avoided the ice cliff and remained in control. Instead, as the storm cloud gathered over the col, we were painfully aware that we had run out of food and gas the previous night. Already dangerously dehydrated, we couldn't risk the possibility of being trapped by a prolonged storm with no way of producing fluid. I was already suffering the dehydrating and weakening effect of a traumatic fracture of a major bone and the consequent internal bleeding. We had no choice. For the sake of a canister of gas to melt ice and snow for warm drinks, we had to carry on. And so we lost control, and nearly our lives. In his book, Simon continues his analysis.
All my agonizing after cutting the rope had not changed anything. My decision had been right. We had both survived. In subsequent years, I have overheard numerous heated debates about the ethics of my decision, and many what-if scenarios. I have met people who are understanding of my actions, and others who are openly hostile. Their second-hand opinions mean nothing compared to the words Joe uttered to me in the tent that night in Peru. With the greater mountaineering skills and experience I now possess, I do not believe that I would get into such a situation again, but if somehow I did, I know that my decision would be the same. In just one respect, I feel I was neglectful. In the extreme stress of my predicament, I came to the conclusion, without a close inspection, that any attempt at rescue in the crevasse was impossible. On reflection, I can see that it would probably have done more harm than good to have tried, but it simply did not occur to me to go to the edge and look carefully into the depths. Ultimately, we all have to look after ourselves, whether on mountains or in day-to-day life. In my view, that is not a license to be selfish, for only by taking good care of ourselves are we able to help others. Away from the mountains, in the complexity of everyday life, the price of neglecting this responsibility might be a marriage breaking down, a disruptive child, a business failing, or a house repossessed. In the mountains, the penalty for neglect can often be death.
Second-hand opinions, as Simon puts it, were never something I paid much attention to after the accident. We knew exactly what had happened between us, and were quite happy with it. I wrote this book in the hope that, by telling the story straight, it might nip in the bud any harsh or unfair criticism of Simon. The rope-cutting had clearly touched a nerve, transgressed some unwritten rule, and people seemed to be drawn to that element of the story until I wrote it down as honestly as I could. Even so, the misinformed opinions of some armchair adventurers were never going to worry either of us for long. Recovering from my injuries and getting back to the mountains were my priorities, not vague speculation by others on what we should or should not have done. 90% of accidents are down to human error. We are fallible, and accidents will happen. I suppose the trick is to anticipate all the possible consequences of what you set out to do, so that if things do go wrong, you're better able to stay in control. I can add only that however painful readers may think our experiences were, for me this book still falls short of articulating just how dreadful were some of those lonely days. I simply could not find the words to express the utter desolation of the experience. Joe Simpson, August 1997. Epilogue. Bad Memories. In mid-July 2002, I stood at the precise point where 17 years earlier Simon Yates had found me on a dark, snow-filled night in the Peruvian Andes. At that time, I had been an emotionally and physically shattered wreck of a human being. I weighed a little under 90 pounds, was suffering from ketoacidosis, and was close to falling into a coma. My body was as near to total exhaustion as it is possible to get without dying. I suspect now, having spoken to a number of doctors, that I probably was dying when Simon found me that night. Now, all these years later, I was uncomfortably aware of the cameraman, the director and the soundman watching expectantly as they pointed a lens and a long furry microphone at me. Simon was standing by my side, explaining to the camera what it had been like to find me, the state I was in, and the way I was lying on the rocks. I seemed to be hearing all this from a distance. I could feel that my heart rate was increasing rapidly, and I was acutely conscious of the surrounding mountains. They seemed to press in on me. I felt out of breath. A hot flush ran through me, and I started sweating copiously. I shifted uncomfortably, hoping the camera was not picking up on these signs. I was feeling strangely vulnerable, as if about to be attacked. In fact, the more I thought about it, the more worried I became. I was asked a question, and I seemed to be hearing it from a long way away. I could hear the blood pumping in my temples. As I started speaking, I was trying furiously not to cry. I had been determined not to give a teary interview, and yet now I was being ambushed. I heard myself talking about the moment Simon and Richard came looking for me in the dark, the sight of their head torches, and that exquisite moment when I realized the nightmare was over and that the rest of my life had just been given back to me. I looked down at the ground where I'd been found lying face down on the rocks, and then glanced up the riverbed of chaotic jumbled boulders. How on earth did I get down that in the dark? The thought seemed to make the feelings of panic stronger. I'm not even sure whether I stopped talking, but for a long moment, as I looked at the ground, I had the feeling of lying there, the uncanny sensation of Simon's hands gripping me by the shoulders and rolling me over and holding me. I almost turned round to see who had touched my shoulders. It was as if something hallucinogenic had happened to my brain. Synapses had crossed. Colours, feelings and sensation from some long, deep, hidden memory had come bursting back with a quite shocking force. Perhaps it lasted a millisecond. It seemed like minutes. Then the moment was gone, and I was left feeling completely unnerved. Simon and I walked back towards where the film crew had reconstructed our original base camp. It looked very familiar. I think Simon must have noticed something. He asked if I was okay. I said, no, not really, and not much more. I wanted to run away. I sat down and tried to calm myself. Externally, I appeared quite normal. Inside, I was feeling hysterical. Back in the huge base camp, 20 minutes' walk down the valley, I began to feel a little better. I went to my tent, poured a shot of whiskey into a tin mug, lit a cigarette, and thought, Joe, that was a panic attack. Don't worry, it's normal. In truth, I don't know what it was. But it was to happen repeatedly over the next 3 weeks, perhaps not so strongly, but that may have been because I was bracing myself for the attacks, telling myself as they came on that it was just my mind playing tricks on me and that it would fade, helped. As we had made the slow 4-day walk-in to the camp, with a 14-strong group comprising the film crew, the safety team, porters, and 76 donkeys, I hadn't the slightest anxiety about being back in that familiar landscape. In fact, it all seemed farcical. Dressing up in 80s-style gear and reenacting the approach with 4 recalcitrant donkeys and the team doctor disguised as Richard Hawking was a combination of hilarious farce and tedious repetition. We tramped past the camera tripod, then scurried around, herding the confused burros back the way they had come so we could do yet another take. "Start walking for camera when you get to the large patch of lupins." This cryptic instruction squawked from the radio, and we glanced at the distant notch on the ridge where the camera with the big 600mm lens fitted was set up. We then examined the steeply angled walls of the V-shaped valley which we were about to traverse. The slopes ran thousands of feet down from a jagged rocky ridge line to the thin glinting sinuous lines of a river far below us. The entire hillside was covered in lupins. When I sighted the snow-covered peaks as we rounded the valley far above the village of Huayapa, I registered only pleasant surprise to see old friends again. The ice-sheathed peaks of Rasac and Yerapaja dominated the head of the valley. My reaction was one of interest rather than foreboding. I had forgotten how beautiful these mountains were, and realized with a start that despite 20 years of climbing mountains all over the world, the Cordillera Wiwash was still the most beautiful mountain range I have ever laid my eyes upon. It made me smile. Then I saw the west face of Sula Grande and felt a tremor of fear. It was bigger and meaner, and so much more threatening than I remembered. It made me wonder at the person I had been all those years ago. I must have been bold, ambitious, or even a little crazy to have considered such an undertaking. I traced the line of our ascent and watched the snow pluming off the north ridge in the strong, high-altitude winds. It scared me. Where had all that drive and passion gone? How had I lost that sense of invincibility, the confidence born of youth, too much testosterone and too little imagination? As I turned from the face and trudged up the jumbled moraine fields on the glacier, I consoled myself with the thought that at least I was here, a little greyer round the temples, only a little wiser, but at least I was here. The days spent reenacting for the camera the crawling on the glacier and the moraines were both surreal and disturbing. I knew everything was being filmed, so that my face could not be recognized when they cut the film in with action reconstructions filmed with actors in the Alps. Nevertheless, it felt irritating to have to go through the unnerving business of dressing up in the same mountaineering clothing, wrapping the yellow foam mat around my right leg, and then pretending to crawl and fall and hop as I had done 17 years earlier. Why couldn't they have just used an actor out here? I kept asking myself. I felt as if I was about to be attacked from behind at any moment. The feelings became most powerful when I was on the moraines or the glacier, and the familiar cirque of mountain ridges dominated my every view. It was a memory that had been seared into my consciousness. Seeing it again all these years later was the trigger that brought back my worst memories and associations. This was the place where I had known I was going to die. Those ridgelines should have been the last thing I would ever see. I should never have come back. It was not cathartic. It was terrifying. Oddly enough, Simon and I hardly spoke to each other about our personal feelings. So much had been written and spoken about the experience, it was as if there was no more to be said, and therefore no point speaking about it. Nothing would change. In our hearts, we knew better than anyone what had happened in this place. It was history, and we had dealt with it. For me, the memories came rushing back with such a clarity and startling vividness that I became convinced at times that the last 17 years had not passed by, and I was back in the terrible reality of 1985, trying to crawl down the mountain. One day I was alone in a narrow, sandy gulch running between the moraines and the valley walls. I sat staring at the miles of jumbled rocks with my legs strapped and the clothes and rucksacks donned, waiting for the radio call from the film crew perched on a high ridge over a mile away. Again I began to panic. In 1985, I had sat in this precise spot, convinced that Simon and Richard were following along behind me. That had been a hallucination, a cocoon of comfort I had hidden in so well that I had believed it completely. It was no weirder than the one that I now seemed to be experiencing 17 years later. I kept peering nervously over my shoulder, trying to make out the people on the ridge. My heart began racing, and I kept sucking in deep, nervous breaths. I thought I might burst into tears. Then I spotted the tiny figures huddled around the camera and tried to calm myself. The sense of menace increased when I heard the rattle of rocks tumbling down the valley walls, and spurts of dust drifted away on the wind. They were uncomfortably close. I glanced back at the ridge. Come on, come on, I want to get out of here. Another volley of rocks spat down towards me. I jerked away instinctively. Seconds later, a feeling of all-consuming panic overwhelmed me. I had to run from the place, had to escape. Just as I began to remove the mat strapped to my leg, the radio squawked into life. "Joe, this is Kevin, do you copy?" I stared at the radio aerial poking from my chest pocket. "Joe, do you copy? You ready for the take?" "Kevin, this is Joe, I copy." I released the transmit button and let out a long sigh of relief. "Okay, Joe, begin to crawl towards the Rocky Narrows, please. In your own time." I began to laugh. It had a slightly manic edge. I was not enjoying my return to Peru. Traumatic emotions, feelings of guilt, regret, sadness and terror travel hardwired neural pathways in a manner that mimics ingrained or archetypal fears. There have been huge advances into the shadows of memory and deep-seated fear. Today scientists are discovering ways to help the brain unlearn fears and inhibitions. Tests on mice and rats have shown that the brain's hormonal reactions to such memories can be inhibited, thereby softening the emotions that they evoke. In short, they are mastering the means of short-circuiting the very wiring of primal fear in the mind. The source of your worst nightmares, real or imagined terrors, radiates from a dense knot of neurons called the amygdala. With each new traumatic experience, or the reliving of an old one, this fear center triggers a release of hormones that sear horrifying impressions on your brain. The unbearable becomes unforgettable. The research is aimed at helping victims fend off the ravages of post-traumatic stress disorder. The first human trials with beta-blocker propranolol have already taken place in America. For the medicine to be effective, patients have to take them as soon after the event as possible. I had always been a little skeptical about the very idea of post-traumatic stress disorder. It seems that everyone gets it nowadays, and I was suspicious that it had become a catch-all to provide exculpation from the past and a convenient way of suing for compensation. Why were not millions of people paralyzed by post-traumatic stress disorders after the First and Second World Wars, both soldiers and civilians alike who bore witness to the most appalling experiences imaginable on a scale never before encountered? Certainly, by the Second World War, shell shock had been recognized as something other than lacking moral fiber. Perhaps the difference, then, was that people did not live in the ghastly blame and compensation culture that we do today. So it came as a surprise to be told on my return from Peru that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. In all likelihood, the memory of the mountains surrounding the moraines and the glacier had been so powerfully ingrained that it had brought the fears of 1985 back to me with quite startling lucidity. It was as if it had happened a few days before. I was told that the effect would soon wear off, since I seemed to have dealt so effectively with the traumas of Sula Grande in the intervening 17 years. I was put on a waiting list for an appointment with a psychotherapist, which was something that I was deeply uncomfortable about. I had always felt a certain disdain, bordering on contempt for the particularly American reliance on therapy and counselling. The very British stiff upper lip approach to such matters seemed the most effective and most dignified remedy. However, I had to admit to feeling pretty strange on my return, so I reluctantly agreed to the appointment. In the meantime, I experienced 8 weeks of mild panic attacks, a tendency to cry unexpectedly, and a persistent feeling of vulnerability. Then I gave a corporate motivational presentation recounting the void story, and within days the symptoms had disappeared. It took 6 months before someone rang me about a possible appointment. I declined the offer with a few choice words about the parlous state of the health service and felt relieved that I hadn't been suffering from a serious mental illness. Telling and retelling the void story had inadvertently proved to be a good treatment for the condition. Apparently, it is common practice for psychotherapists to make a victim recount as vividly as they can the full horrors of their experience. With each telling of their real story, it gradually becomes a fiction, becomes someone else's experience, and they can separate themselves from the trauma. In short, the hardwired neural pathways to the amygdala, the fear center, are blocked, or at very least bypassed. When I went to see one of the first screenings of the drama documentary at a theater in Soho, I was filled with mixed emotions. I was relieved that it was all over, and something had at last been made after more than 10 years of negotiating movie deals for the rights of the book. At one point, it had been sold to a combined production company involving Sally Field and Tom Cruise. It was meant to be a star vehicle for Cruise, which caused general hilarity in the climbing world, and many jokes about Nicole Kidman playing the part of Simon. I knew at the time that if the film were ever made, it would be the usual tripe that the Hollywood studios serve up each year. They were, however, paying an awful lot of money to make tripe. When the deal fell through and the rights reverted to me, I was pleased to hear that a respected drama documentary company, Darlow Smithson, were interested in the rights. With Kevin MacDonald, an Oscar-winning drama documentary director on board, I had hopes that maybe a respectable film of the book might be made. By the time I entered the theatre, I had no idea what it was going to be like. Apart from my own personal difficulties in Peru, the whole business of filmmaking had proved to be both staggeringly tedious and utterly confusing. I was painfully aware of how easy it would be to make a complete mess filming the book. 1 hour and 40 minutes later, I sat in my seat as the credits rolled, feeling pleased and anxious. The film was remarkably faithful to the book, and although I am the last person to judge it, I felt it was a powerful and emotional production. I was anxious because I had not realized how exposed Simon and I would be until I saw the way we narrated the entire story to camera. Neither of us had ever sought that sort of public exposure, and it made for uncomfortable viewing. If hearing a recording of your own voice feels odd, seeing yourself on a big screen is downright disturbing. It is always difficult to make a satisfactory film of a popular book, but in this case, they seem to have succeeded. That, however, is for readers and viewers to judge. The real experience, of which I had been so powerfully reminded, would always distance Simon and me from any written or celluloid representation. Oddly enough, the physical and emotional trauma experienced in Peru in 1985 did not change my life. It was the success of Touching the Void and my future writing and speaking career that materially changed me. The making of the film will no doubt bring further changes and challenges. I often wonder what would have happened to my life if we had not had the accident on Sula Grande. A part of me thinks that I would have gone on to climb harder and harder routes, taking greater risks each time. Given the toll of friends over the years, I'm not confident that I would be alive today. In those days, I was a penniless, narrow-minded, anarchic, abrasive, and ambitious mountaineer. The accident opened up a whole new world for me. Without it, I would never have discovered hidden talents for writing and public speaking. Despite having worked hard, I do sometimes wonder whether I just got lucky. In Peru, we had gone to unusual lengths to take the ultimate risk, and yet, despite all the pain and trauma, it now seems a small price to pay for such an inspiring adventure. Isn't memory a wonderful deceiver? Almost losing everything in Peru was a sensation quite as life-enhancing as winning. I seem to have been on a worryingly long winning streak ever since. Where will it all end? It is a hot, sunny day in Sheffield as I struggle to write my seventh book, a novel. I'm trying not to be distracted by a forthcoming fly-fishing holiday in Ireland, followed by a fourth attempt on the north face of the Eiger. A busy autumn of speaking engagements and publicity for the release of the film beckons. Fighting for my life on Sula Grande 17 years ago seems to have turned me into a successful businessman, which is very odd. Life can deal you an amazing hand. Do you play it steady, bluff like crazy, or go all in? I'll never know. Joe Simpson, July 2003. Touching the Void is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Joe Simpson, 1988. Copyright in recording, Random House Audiobooks. Joe Simpson has asserted his right under the CDPA 1988 to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.